Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for Wednesday, June 8th, 2022. And I am your reader, Peter Welch. What are you doing? Son of Buffalo victims challenges lawmakers to legislate or resign. In Washington, the son of Ruth Whitefield, an 86-year-old woman killed when a gunman opened fire in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York, challenged Congress Tuesday to act against the cancer of white supremacy and the nation's epidemic of gun violence. Garnell Whitefield Jr.'s emotional testimony comes as lawmakers work to strike a bipartisan agreement on gun safety measures in the aftermath of back-to-back mass shootings, 10 days after the shooting death of his mother and nine others in New York. Another 18-year-old gunman with a semi-automatic rifle opened fire in Uvalde, Texas, killing 19 school children and two teachers. What are you doing? You are elected to protect us, Whitefield Jr. told members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Is there nothing that you personally are willing to do to stop the cancer of white supremacy and the domestic terrorism it inspires? He asked. If there is nothing, then respectfully, senators, you should yield your positions of authority and influence to others that are willing to lead on this issue. The hearing is the first of two this week as families of the victims and survivors of the mass shootings in Buffalo hearings and events on Capitol Hill to show the human toll of America's gun violence and urge Congress to act. Pressing for a deal, President Joe Biden met Tuesday with Senator Chris Murphy, a key Democratic negotiator who has worked most of his career trying to curb the nation's mass shootings scourge after the slaughter of 20 children at Sandy Hook Elementary in his home state of Connecticut a decade ago. Murphy told reporters after the meeting that he was grateful to have an opportunity to update the president on the talks. Obviously, we've still got work to do in the Senate, he said. Murphy said his goal is to try to get an agreement this week. But he added that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has been clear that we need some extra time to dot the I's and cross the T's that will get it. On Wednesday, the House Oversight Committee is expected to hear from more victims' families and from fourth grader Mia Cirilio, who captured Americans' attention after she described covering herself in her dead classmate's blood and playing dead to survive the shooting rampage in Uvalde. The Senate hearing Tuesday focused directly on the white supremacist ideology that authorities say led an 18-year-old gunman dressed in military gear to drive hours to a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo and live stream his violent rampage. The shooting left 10 people dead and several others wounded. My mother's life mattered, Whitefield said. Your actions here will tell us if and how much it mattered to you. Shortly after the Buffalo massacre, a bill that would have bolstered federal resources to prevent domestic terrorism failed in the Senate at the hands of Republican opposition. Even at Tuesday's hearing, Republican senators took the time to focus on the racial injustice protests that took place in the summer of 2020, citing those incidents as acts of domestic extremism. Since the failed vote, senators have regrouped and began to meet privately in a small bipartisan group headed by Murphy and Republican Senator John Conrad, trying to hash out a compromise that could actually become law. But lawmakers have been here before, unable to pass any substantial gun safety laws in decades in the face of steep objections from Republicans in Congress, some conservative Democrats, and the fierce lobby of gun owners and the National Rifle Association. No major legislation has made it into law since the 1994 assault weapons ban, which has since expired. The issue for Democrats is that a number of the topics with bipartisan support would likely not have stopped either the shooting in Buffalo or Uvalde, and the ones that gun safety advocates argue would have been met with a deep reluctance from Republicans. One such proposal would raise the age requirement for gun purchases from age 18 to age 21. Another popular measure among Democrats would have banned assault-style rifles altogether. Instead, senators are focusing on incremental policy changes through a system that would send funds and other incentives to the states to bolster security of school campuses, provide more mental health services to young people, and possibly encourage states to pursue red flag laws to keep firearms out of the hands of people who would do harm. We know we won't get it all done at once, Schumer said Tuesday afternoon, but the American people want us to get something done, and they want to see Republicans do something. His counterpart across the aisle seemed to echo the sentiment. Almost everybody would like to get an outcome, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell told reporters. And now turning to some other news, Cerro Gordo County voters take to polls, turnout for primary higher than expected. Cerro Gordo County Auditor Adam Weedmore said that there was a greater vote turnout on Tuesday than was expected countywide. He added that he thought people were turning out because of the contested races, especially at the local levels. The voter turnout is very good. We came into today with a good absentee number, said Weedmore. Highland Park Golf Course voting location saw 19 voters come in to cast their ballot around 8:30 a.m. Polling Judge Donna Brayton said that the voters who came to Highland tend to be working individuals. If we get busy, it'll probably be between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., said Brayton. Brayton also said that they had enough voters to help out with the day and no issues with equipment during the morning hours. She gave kudos to the Cerro Gordo County Auditor's Office for making things so far run smoothly. As Brayton described the morning turnout, 5 voters walked into the door to vote. Over at the Trinity Lutheran Church polling location, Deb Brock said that they had seen 7 voters in the morning hours. It does pick up, said Brock. Brock, similar to Brayton, said that they had enough volunteers and technology was running smoothly for them. She added turnout would pick up the closer to the end of the work day. I think it will be a little slower turnout, but the courthouse was encouraged, said Brock. Zion Lutheran Church in Clear Lake saw more than 40 voters in the first 2 hours of opening. It's been steady so far, said Becky Butts, chairperson, which we appreciate as the day goes on. Voters didn't have to wait in line this morning at Zion to vote. And a few of the voters commented that they've been voting regularly for years. It's an honor to be able to come and choose my representative, said one voter. In the afternoon, Highland Park Golf Course had a reported 94 voters, according to Brayton. She added that she was surprised how even the Republicans and Democrat turnout had been so far. It's way better than expected, Brayton said. Brighton also said being busy of a polling place is good to not hit a wall or losing stamina. Highland Park Golf Course and Trinity Lutheran Church polling volunteers kept high spirits by checking in with each other. Trinity Lutheran had seen 51 voters by the afternoon and was described as a slow and steady turnout, according to Brock. By supper break, supposedly, we will see more, said Brock. By Tuesday afternoon, Clear Lake City Hall counted more than 182 voters from their precinct. Since there was a higher turnout, Weedmore said that they were staying in constant contact with the polling places in case additional ballots are needed. Ballots are treated like money, according to Weedmore, and are given to certain locations based on previous election turnouts at those locations. We want everyone to vote, but we don't want to overproduce ballots, Weedmore said. And moving over here to Clear Lake now, One Vision ends transit contract with NIACOG. One Vision in Clear Lake has been a provider of public transit over 10 counties for more than 20 years, but it's decided not to renew its contract with the North Iowa Area Council of Governments and relayed the reasoning to the Clear Lake City Council during its meeting Monday night. One Vision's contract ends on June 30th, 2022, and the organization is working closely with NIACOG to find a service to work through the counties in the interim. Mark Dodd, CEO of One Vision, and Mario Van Dijk, CFO, were present at the meeting to explain the decision not to renew the contract due to the pressures of increased costs of insurance and the increased difficulty in finding a carrier willing to issue a policy to us. If we continue to operate those transit services, we were left with no reasonable options other than to not continue that, said Dodd. 3 years ago, One Vision faced similar issues, but decided to work through them and renew the contract. With the exacerbation of these problems due to COVID and inflation, Dodd expressed that One Vision could not work through these issues again. I do hope that the council understands that this was a very difficult decision for us to make, and we did not make it lightly. And we explored all possible options in terms of insurance coverage and options for us to continue to move forward with this. And unfortunately, we're not able to make that decision at this point in time, Dodd said of the decision. One Vision currently has a fleet of at least 60 transit vehicles working across 10 counties. The organization will continue to work with NIACOG as they find an interim service solution under a different model short term. Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory expressed his gratitude to One Vision for their service. We're glad for the years of service that you did. It's unfortunate, I understand the situation, but hopefully we can figure a path forward. Public Works Director Jeremy Korenberg was present at the meeting to recommend buying the 2022 Western Star from Truck Center Companies in Clear Lake. Public Works has budgeted $185,000 for a new tandem axle roll-off truck, as the old truck needs to be retired. The estimated delivery day for the truck is set in November of 2022. The hook and roll-off will be added separately in January of 2023. Considering the time we're in, getting a truck within 6 months is really good, said Korenberg. The purchase was approved by council. Korenberg provided the updates of two projects in Clear Lake. The 2021 water main and storm sewer improvement project continues on, with subcontractors installing a storm sewer by the new Clear Lake Athletics and Wellness Center. Paving is being done on the 20th Street and 12th Street in phases and should be completed by next week. The contract completion date for this project is set for June 17th, and Korenberg believes that the project will be substantially completed by that date. The 400 block of Main Avenue Alley project has been substantially completed, according to Korenberg. Only lighting is left to be done on the project, which the city and Alliant Energy will work on. This should not impede the alley from being open. Thank you, Jeremy, for your work on the 400 Main Alley project. That is really a dramatic improvement from what it was, thanked Bennett Smith, council person. In other news, Public Works also helped the Clear Lake Fire Department install their new dock by pouring cement. The Seawall Rehabilitation Improvement Project project consultant has filed the certificate of completion for the project. The project's final value is $244,385. The city's budgeted $250,000 for the project. A professional services agreement with RDG for feasibility study for a new hotel in the Surfs District was approved. During the mayor's report, Nelson Crabb celebrated recent events. The try went off very well. I thought I stood there and was freezing. I couldn't believe that some of those hundreds of people of all ages were getting in the water, and the water temp was 60 degrees. What a sight to see. What an event to have here. So well done, so well organized, and drew an awful lot of people here. Crabb also applauded the spring sports athletes this year. The great success of Thursdays on Main and one of the largest turnouts Crabb has seen in years for Memorial Day. Scott Flory indicated during the city administrator report that the city of golf course cart shed is moving forward in repairs. Main Avenue tree planting is beginning, and the developer has indicated intent to move forward on the South 8th Street housing subdivision project. A letter of intent is expected at a future Clear Lake City Council meeting. The council also took under advisement a growing problem in Clear Lake. Chris Swears of K&C Tree Service came forward during the citizens' opportunity portion of the meeting to discuss emerald ash borers infesting Clear Lake. Ash trees have been receiving treatments in Mason City in past years, but Swears said that he has found infested trees at and in Clear Lake. Swears noted an infestation about a block and a half west of City Hall, where two ash trees were killed by the pests. Swears noted a 99% mortality rate for trees that are infested and a 99% effectiveness rate of treatment as long as treatment starts before infestation shows. You need to get out ahead of it, Swears noted. Several ash trees in Clear Lake. I just wanted to have a conversation and make you guys aware of it. And going over to Waterloo, Charles City man arrested on gun charges. In Waterloo, a Charles City man has been arrested for allegedly pointing a gun at a pregnant woman in Waterloo on Monday. Police arrested Tyroskus Rakim Matlock, age 31, for prohibited person in possession of a firearm, carrying weapons, and second offense domestic assault. Bond was initially set at $10,000. Court records allege Matlock was involved in a verbal agreement with a woman who was 7 months pregnant at a Russell Road home Monday morning. He then kicked her in the stomach and put his hands around her neck, records say. Before he left, he pulled out a pistol, pointed it at her, and told her to get out of the way or she would be dead, records state. Waterloo officers stopped Matlock on U.S. Highway 218 around noon while he was apparently headed back to Charles City. In the trunk of his vehicle, investigators found a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson pistol with an extended magazine. If you enjoy the Globe Gazette and you'd like to share something, we'd like to know about it. Any tip that you might have that we could possibly publish, We're committed to reporting stories that help our readers connect with their community, especially breaking news and matters of public safety. So if you see news that you think we should report, please consider becoming a part of North Iowa's local journalism efforts. You'll find a new link on our website's navigation menu labeled News Tip. Tapping that link from your smartphone or your tablet or your computer will launch a short form that allows you to send news tips or story ideas directly to our editors. The News Tip form requires you to submit a phone number and email address. We will not publish that information, but it will help our editors verify the news tip or seek additional information. News tips cannot be submitted anonymously. Also, we cannot guarantee that the news coverage on every tip or story idea will be published. The news tip features is not for press releases, letters to the editors, obituaries, or advertising. Please use the normal channels for that content. Also, readers may continue to contact journalists directly by telephone or by email. News tip is just an additional way for you to communicate with us. And looking statewide, now we're going to take a look at Iowa farmland values. And right now, at this point in time, the values are up 28%. Demand for high-quality farmland has forced prices for acres to new highs, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Iowa farmland values shot up 28% from April 1, 2021 to April 1, 2022, said the author of the Ag Letter, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago economist David Opdahl. Farmland values during the 12 months from April 1, 2021 to April 1, 2022 in the 7th Federal Reserve District shot up 23%, he added. The 7th Federal Reserve District comprises Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Michigan did not participate in the land value survey. Indiana's farmland values rose 23% during the period, while Wisconsin's rose by 13%. Opdahl said that demand for agricultural land had shifted higher given additional government payments, strong farm returns in 2021, and outside interest from investors. The number and acreage of farms for sale has risen. Its supply has been outpaced by demand, Opdahl said. Farmland values and cash rents, he said, have risen partly because of elevated farm earnings. Many agricultural prices were propelled higher by world events, for instance, drought in South America and parts of the U.S., as well as the war in Ukraine, Opdahl said. In March, prices received by farmers were up 31% from a year ago, according to USDA data, he added. Also, prices for livestock and associated products were up 39% in March from a year ago, and crop prices were up 22%, Opdahl continued to say. Despite rising input costs and the slowing of federal pandemic relief, he said these large increases in agricultural prices helped raise the farm sector's overall income, which in turn helped boost farmland values and cash rents. The 23% gain in the 7th District was just above the 22% rise from January 1, 2021 to January 1, 2022 that was reported by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago in February. According to that survey, Iowa's farmland values rose by 30% during the 12-month January 1st to January 1st time frame. For the first quarter of 2022, Iowa's farmland values rose 3%. Scott County farmer Brian Seaver said that locally it appeared it was farmers buying the property. There were three farms that recently sold, and they sold anywhere from $12,500 an acre to $17,600 an acre, depending on the farm and the quality of the land and its use, Sievers continued to say. Farmers used for seed corn productions have a much higher potential for return, he said. Two of those who purchased farmland were young farmers, and that's always encouraging to me. Sievers continued to say that the farms sold ranged in size from 80 acres to 150 acres. There was a farm of just under 80 acres that sold for $17,600 an acre, he said. Sievers said that he was expecting high interest rates to temper the market at some point. Some of the investors over the past year are taking a much more cautious approach, he said. That may take an active bidder out of the market, but it does allow someone who has come in second in bidding before to make a purchase. Of course, it takes the right kind of financial investment. Iowa State University economist Wendong Zhang, who produces the annual Iowa Farmland Value Survey, said that the growth in farmland values was slowing a bit. Several unique factors are behind this remarkable increase. Interest rates are at historically low levels amid COVID-19 uncertainty. Commodity prices are substantially higher, in part due to stronger export demand. Crop yields are stronger than expected, despite the weather challenges throughout the growing season. Substantial ad hoc federal COVID-19 related government payments and stronger demand from investors nudged by inflation concerns and lack of alternative investment options, Zhang continued to say. Our analysis shows that the interest rate hikes this year is still not sufficient in offsetting the support of low interest rates for land values, but the downward pressure could be felt later, next fall in 2023, he says. Plus, the land supply is still fairly tight, and both farmers and investors' demands are higher. Zhang said that the recent projections from a conference that he ran, the Soil Management and Land Valuation Conference, forecast the land value will continue to rise another 3 to 5% over the next 6 months, and probably will stabilize for 2023 and 2024. The higher input costs are eroding the profits, but it seems that the profits are still there, he says. Zhang said that Farm Credit Services of America chief appraiser Kirk Manker commented in 2015 that only half of their clients were making money. In 2021, the percent is 97%. So at least now, the signs are not showing a potential burst of the bubble. But the growth is definitely slowing, Zhang went on to say. And let's turn to some other news. Paramount Pictures sued over Top Gun. The widow and son of the man who wrote the 1983 article that inspired the original Top Gun are suing Paramount Pictures over its sequel, Top Gun Maverick. In a complaint filed in California federal court on Monday, Shosh Yanay and Yuval Yanay claimed that the rights to Yuad Yanay's story reverted back to them on January 24, 2020. The lawsuit contends that Paramount, which produced and distributed the sequel, did not require those rights before releasing the film in May. A spokesperson for Paramount Pictures said in a statement that the claims are without merit and we will defend ourselves vigorously. The lawsuit says that Paramount has been on notice since 2018 that the Yanays intended to recover the copyright under a provision that lets artists do so after 35 years. According to the suit, the Yanays sent a cease and desist letter in early May to which Paramount responded that the film had been sufficiently completed by January 24, 2020, and was not derivative of Yanay's article. The Yanays countered that the film is a derivative of the 1983 article, and that Top Gun Maverick didn't wrap until May 2021, more than a year after the rights expired. Yonet's original article about the Navy Fighter Weapons School training program and two pilots in the course, the hotshots Yogi and his friend Possum, was published in May 1983 issue of California Magazine, soon after Paramount Pictures acquired the exclusive motion picture rights. Top Gun was released in 1986 and went on to become the number one film of the year. You're listening to the Globe Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituary notices today, so we're going to continue with the news. 100-acre Iowa farm sells for $2.6 million at auction. In Lamars, Iowa, a farm in Plymouth County sold for $25,000 an acre on Friday, a price more than twice as high as the average in the county. Bruce R. Brock, whose Brock Auction Company conducted the sale, said that the land, about 96.33 acres of farmland and a 3.67 acre farm place at 38625 200th Street, a gravel road about 5 miles southeast of Lamars, sold for a total of more than $2.6 million. The buyers are neighbors to the north of the farm, who Brock described as a great farm family. The land, which Brock described as top quality, was put up for sale following the death of Eileen L. Rowling, the owner of the farm. Rowling's husband had died several years earlier. The family had owned the land for decades. I think it was a very good farm, no question about it, Brock said in a phone call on Sunday. It had a lot going for it. It didn't take on any water from anybody else. There was just a teeny little bit of slope to it so that the water drained well off it. It was top quality soil in a good high state of productivity. As a description of the farm on Brock's auction website put it, what more could you want? The auction was attended by more than 100 people, Brock said. The price was well above average farmland values in Plymouth County or anywhere else in the state. As of 2021, an average acre of farmland in Plymouth County was valued at around $12,416, a 31.4% increase from the year prior, according to Iowa State University data. The figure was the fourth highest in the state, behind only Sioux, O'Brien, and Lyon counties. Farmland in northwest Iowa is generally the richest and most valuable in the state. Statewide, farmland values were up an average of 29% last year, according to ISU data. Prices are likely to increase further this year as the war in Ukraine constricts global grain supplies, driving up farm revenues and the value of land. Last year, in the last couple months in 2020, we sold $78 million worth of land, and it just steadily went up and up and up and up and up, said Brock, who predicted that farm prices are likely to continue on their up path with a possible retracement or two for a short period of time. Then the land will come back strong. It's a good investment. There's no question about it, he said. There's a lot of interest. We get several calls a week from people looking for farmland of all types. And now let's take a look at national news. United Nations. EU blames Russia for food crisis. European Council President Charles Michel accused Russia of using food supplies as a stealth missile against developing countries and blamed the Kremlin for the looming global food crisis, prompting Moscow's UN ambassador to walk out of a Security Council meeting. Michel addressed Russian Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia directly at the council meeting Monday, saying he saw millions of tons of grain and wheat stuck in containers and ships at the Ukrainian port of Odessa a few weeks ago. That was because of Russian warships in the Black Sea, said Moscow's attacks on transport infrastructure and grain storage facilities and its tanks, bombs, and mines that are preventing Ukraine from planting and harvesting, he went on to say. This is driving up food prices, pushing people into poverty, and destabilizing entire regions, Michael said. Russia is solely responsible for this looming food crisis. Russia alone. Michael also accused Russian forces of stealing grain from areas it has occupied while shifting the blame of others, calling this cowardly and propaganda pure and simple. Nebrenzia walked out during Michael's briefing, giving Russia's seat to another diplomat. Russia's deputy UN ambassador Dmitry Polensky tweeted later on Telegram's Russians channel that Michael's comments were so rude that the Russian ambassador left the Security Council chamber. The Security Council meeting was supposed to focus on sexual violence during the war in Ukraine, but Russia's invasion and the consequences, especially on global food shortages and rising prices, were also raised. Michael gave strong backing to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' efforts to get a package agreement that would allow grain exports from Ukraine and ensure that Russian food and fertilizer have unrestricted access to global markets. Ukraine and Russia together produce about a third of the world's wheat and barley and half of its sunflower oil, while Russia and its ally Belarus are the world's number two and three producers of potash, a key ingredient of fertilizer. Guterres warned last month that global hunger levels are at a new high, with the number of people facing severe food insecurity doubling in just 2 years, from 135 million before the COVID-19 pandemic to 276 million today. He said more than 500,000 people are living in famine conditions, an increase of more than 500% since 2016. Ukraine's UN ambassador Sergei Kislytseya told the Security Council on Monday that the country remains committed to finding solutions to prevent the global food crisis and is ready to create the necessary conditions to resume exports from the key southern ports of Odessa. Let's now continue to look at nation and world news. There is a caption with a number of soldiers with high-capacity rifles, and the headline says, Russia claims to make advances in Donbas region. Civilian militia hold rifles Tuesday during training at a shooting range in the outskirts of Kyiv in Ukraine. Russia on Tuesday claimed to have taken control of 97% of one of the two provinces that make up Ukraine's Donbas, bringing the Kremlin closer to its goal of fully capturing the eastern industrial heartland of coal mines and factories after abandoning its bungled attempt to storm Kyiv 2 months ago. Russia declared that taking the entire Donbas is its main objective. Moscow-backed separatists have battled Ukrainian government forces there since 2014, and the region has borne the brunt of the Russian onslaught in recent weeks. In other news, World Bank dims its outlook. U.S. Treasury Secretary, inflation should be number one priority in Washington. The World Bank sharply downgraded its outlook for the global economy on Tuesday, pointing to Russia's war against Ukraine, the prospect of widespread food shortages, and concerns about the potential return of stagflation, a toxic mix of high inflation and sluggish growth. The 189-country agency predicted that the world economy will expand 2.9% this year. That would be down from 5.7% global growth in 2021 and from 4.1% it had forecast for 2022 back in January. For many countries, recession will be hard to avoid, said David Malpass, the World Bank's president. The agency doesn't forecast, or rather, foresee, rather, a much brighter picture in 2023 and 2024. It predicts just 3% global growth for both years. Also on Tuesday, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen acknowledged that she and Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell could have used a better word than transitory when describing the expected run of inflation in the U.S. economy. She added that she was hopeful it would soon be on the decline. I do expect inflation to remain high, although I very much hope that it will be coming down now, Yellen told the Senate Finance Committee during a hearing on the agency's latest budget request. I think that bringing inflation down should be our number one priority. For the United States alone, the World Bank slashed its growth forecast to 2.5% this year from 5.7% in 2021 and from the 3.7% it had forecast in January. For the 19 European countries that share the euro currency, it's downgraded the growth currency. It downgraded the outlook by 2.5% this year from 5.4% last year and from the 4.2% it had expected in January. Emerging market and developing economies are collectively forecast to grow 3.4% this year, decelerating from a 6.6 pace in 2021. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has severely disrupted global trade in energy and wheat, battering a global economy that was recovering robustly from the coronavirus pandemic. Already high commodity prices have gone even higher as a result. The World Bank expects oil prices to surge 42% this year and for non-energy commodity prices to climb nearly 18%. Now, let's turn to News Digest. DHS warns of rise in extremist violence. In Washington, a looming Supreme Court decision on abortion, an increase of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, and the midterm elections are potential triggers for extremist violence over the next 6 months, the Department of Homeland Security said on Tuesday. The U.S. was a heightened threat environment already, and these factors may worsen the situation, DHS said in the latest National Terrorism Advisory System Bulletin. It's the latest attempt by Homeland Security to draw attention to the threat posed by domestic violent extremism, a shift from alerts about international terrorism that were a hallmark of the agency following its creation in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks. Official is no show at Uvalde Council in Uvalde, Texas. The school district police chief criticized for waiting too long before ordering law enforcement to confront and kill the gunman during a mass shooting at a Texas elementary school did not appear at a city council meeting in Uvalde on Tuesday, despite being newly elected to the panel. Mayor Don McLaughlin said he was unable to explain why the district police chief Pete Arnando wasn't at the brief meeting. 2 weeks ago, 19 students and two teachers were killed at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. Law enforcement and the state officials have struggled to present an accurate timeline and details and have stopped releasing information about the police response. McLaughlin told the reporters at the meeting that he was frustrated with the lack of information. We want facts and answers, just like everybody else, the mayor went on to say. In other news, briefly, Novavax. American adults who haven't yet gotten vaccinated against COVID-19 may soon get another choice. As advisors to the Food and Drug Administration Tuesday backed a more traditional type of shot. Next, the FDA must decide whether to authorize the protein vaccine made by Novavax as the nation's fourth coronavirus shot for adults. North Korea, the United States, and its Asian allies flew dozens of fighter jets over waters surrounding the Korean Peninsula on Tuesday in a show of force as their diplomats discussed a coordinated response to a possible North Korean nuclear test. American ISIS, Allison Fluke Ekren, an American woman who prosecutors say led an all-female battalion of Islamic State militants in Syria, pleaded guilty on Tuesday in a case that prosecutors called a first of its kind in the United States. Border wall, the trial of Colorado businessman Timothy Shea on charges that he ripped off thousands of donors who contributed $25 million to a campaign to build a wall along the southern U.S. border ended Tuesday in a mistrial after jurors could not reach a unanimous verdict in a prosecution that once featured one-time Trump advisor Steve Bannon. Yacht seizure. The United States won a legal battle on Tuesday to seize a Russian-owned superyacht in Fiji and wasted no time in taking command of the $325 million vessel and sailing it away from the South Pacific nation. And finally, in news briefs, inmate transport. Texas prison system has temporarily stopped transporting inmates as it investigates how a convicted murderer escaped from a bus last month and later killed a man and his four grandsons. Gonzalo Lopez, who had killed on behalf of Mexican drug cartels, fled a prison bus on May 12th after breaking free from his restraints and from a caged area of the vehicle. And now let's turn to the record news here on the Globe Gazette paper. Classroom violence, threats compound teachers' stress. In Charleston, West Virginia, teacher Jessica Sophia was putting up graduation balloons last month at her West Virginia high school when two of them popped, setting off panic in a crowded hallway between classes. One student dropped to the floor. Two others lunged into open classrooms. Sophia quickly shouted, "It's a balloon! Balloons!" and apologized as the teenagers realized the noise didn't come from gunshots. The moment of terror at Spring Mills High School in Martinsburg, about 80 miles northwest of Washington, D.C., happened May 23rd, the day before a gunman fatally shot 19 children and two teachers in a classroom in Uvalde, Texas. The reaction reflects the fear that pervades the nation's schools and taxes its teachers, even those who have never experienced such violence. And it comes on top of the strain imposed by the coronavirus pandemic. Sophia has a more direct connection to gun threats than most. Her mother, also a West Virginia teacher, found herself staring down a student with a gun in her classroom 7 years ago. After talking to him for more than 2 hours, she was hailed for her role in helping bring the incident to a peaceful end. For any teacher standing in front of a classroom in 21st century America, the job seems to ask the impossible. Already expected to be guidance counselors, social workers, surrogate parents, and more to their students, teachers are sometimes called on to be protectors, too. The U.S. public school landscape has changed markedly since the Columbine school shooting in Colorado in 1999. And Sophia said, teachers think about the risks every day. What would happen if we go into a lockdown? What would happen if I hear gunshots? She said. What would happen if one of my students came to school armed that day? This is a constant thread of thought. George Theo Harris was a teacher and principal for a decade and has spent the past 18 years training teachers and school administrators at Syracuse University. He said teachers are stretched more now than ever, even more than last year when the pandemic was newer. We're sort of left in this moment where we do expect teachers and schools to solve all our problems and do it quickly, he said. Schools nationwide have been dealing with widespread episodes of misbehavior since the return to in-person learning, which has been accompanied by soaring student mental health needs. In growing numbers, teens have been turning to gun violence to resolve spur-of-the-moment conflicts, researchers say. In Nashville, Tennessee, three Inglewood Elementary school staffers sprang into action last month to restrain a man who had hopped a fence. After children on the playground were directed inside, the man followed them, but he was tackled by a kindergarten teacher, Rachel Davis. At one point, Secretary Katrina Nikki Thomas held him in a headlock. They and school bookkeeper Shay Patton cornered the man, who didn't have a gun, inside the school until authorities arrived. All three employees were hurt. The three employees watched in horror less than 2 weeks later as news of the Uvalde shooting unfolded. In my head, immediately I thought, that could have been me and my kids, Davis said. That could have been us out there on that playground with this guy if he had had a gun on him. Adding to frustration for some educators was the scapegoating of a teacher initially blamed for propping open the door a gunman used to enter the Uvalde, Texas elementary school. Days later, officials said that the teacher had closed the door, but it didn't lock. Kindergarten teacher Anna Hernandez said Texas educators are anxious after a rough patch that has lasted years and shows no sign of ending. She and a group of colleagues from Dilley drove an hour to Uvalde to do all they could, delivering donated stuffed animals and cases of water. She said more is needed. Changes have to be done for us to feel secure in a classroom as a teacher and for students also to feel secure and safe in a classroom, she said. Tish Jennings, a University of Virginia education professor specializing in teacher stress and social-emotional learning, said the teacher's stress becomes contagious. It interferes with their ability to function, and it also interferes with students' ability to learn, Jennings says. So when things like this happen, the school shootings, it shuts everybody down. It's very hard to learn when you're afraid for your life. There's also a sense that tragedies continue to happen and politicians rarely do anything about it. It is so hard to know that at any moment that reality could also be your reality or the reality of your children, said Sophia, a mother of three students. In August 2015, the new school year had barely started for Sophia's mother, teacher Twyla Smith, when a freshman entered Smith's World Studies classroom at Philip Barber High School and drew a gun he had taken from his home. For about 45 minutes, Smith said no one outside the room knew the class was being held hostage. She diverted his attention from other students and tried to keep him talking while she walked around the room with him. Eventually, police persuaded the boy to let everyone go. And that does it for the reading of the Globe Gazette for today, for June 8th, 2022. I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.